Today's presentation is Voting During the Pandemic by David Cannon. It relates to our fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. David Cannon is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He received his PhD from the University of Minnesota and previously taught at Duke University. His teaching and research interests are in American political institutions, especially Congress and elections. His more specific research interests include racial representation, partisan realignments, political careers, and election administration. He is author of Race Redistricting and Representation, The Dysfunctional Congress with Ken Meyer, Actors, Athletes, and Astronauts, Political Amateurs in the U.S. Congress, American Politics Today with William Bianco, and several edited books and various articles and book chapters. He currently serves as editor of the Election Journal. And so here is David Cannon.
Good to be with you. Thanks for inviting me this morning. So I'm going to share my screen because I have some slides, especially some maps and other things that are good to have. And then Badger Talks wanted me to also share the little introductory slide here. But I wanted to include the Prairie UU little logo there too, because just a shout out to you all. Okay, so just starting with the really basic point that probably for this audience, I don't need to convince you why voting matters, but sometimes it is instructive, I think, to just be reminded how close presidential elections even can be. In Florida in 2000, the Bush versus Gore election, just one vote per precinct in Florida would have tipped the outcome of that election. So just if one voter, it would have gone to the polls and changed, either gone to vote for Gore or switched a vote, would have made the difference in that election. In 2016 with Trump and Clinton, just under 78,000 votes in three states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, had those flipped, that would have changed the outcome of the 2016 election. So again, just unbelievably close. And we're talking, you know, an election with, you know, well over 100 million votes cast. The other way that voting matters too is one that sometimes you can lose sight of, but this is one that I remind my students of this all the time, because politicians do pay attention to people who vote. And there's a lot of research showing that, you know, one reason that, say, Social Security and Medicare are such well-regarded and protected policies in this country is because older people vote, and Social Security and Medicare are obviously really important to older people, whereas policies that are more important to younger people, like, say, having college tuition debts paid for and making college tuition free for more people, you know, that doesn't get as much traction because younger people don't vote as much. And you can see there's, you know, it's a straight linear relationship between age and voting. The older you are, the more you vote. And it's just until you hit like about 80 and then it flattens out a little bit. But it's, you know, something that does have an impact on policy as well. And then finally, just the really fundamental point that democracy depends on holding politicians accountable. And if we don't vote, we're not able to hold our leaders accountable. Now, just visually to illustrate this point, and this is a pretty sort of powerful indicator of how important voting is. Here's an electoral college map that you normally don't see. You know, usually, you know, you'll see the electoral college map in red and blue America, the states that Trump carried and the states that Clinton carried in 2016. Well, this shows a different take on the electoral college map, showing that the states also including the percentage of people who did not vote. And all of the kind of tan states here, so most of the country, there were more people who didn't vote than voted for either Clinton or Trump. And so the people who didn't vote carried 471 electoral votes. Hillary Clinton carried 51, Colorado, Minnesota, Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Delaware, Maryland. Clinton actually got more votes than the people who didn't vote or Trump. And then Wisconsin and Iowa are the only two states in the country that Trump actually got more votes than the people who didn't vote. So that's a very, again, sort of powerful visual reminder of how important it is to vote. And I think in 2020, turnout is certainly going to be higher than it was in 2016, but still they're going to be, maybe 40% of the people aren't going to vote. And so that's another important reminder there. Now, this also is something that comes as a surprise to some people, is that there's actually no affirmative right to vote in the United States Constitution. The 15th, 19th, and 26th Amendments do prevent discrimination based on race, gender, and age, respectively, for 18 to 20-year-olds getting the right to vote with the 26th Amendment. But also, and this is, again, something that goes back to the original document, is that there's no right to vote for president even in the Constitution unless our state legislature gives it to us. There were some states early on where the state legislature decided their electoral votes. There wasn't a popular vote. And, pretty quickly, every state did use the popular vote to determine the electoral votes in their state. But that's not written in the Constitution. The state legislatures decide how their electoral votes are allocated. Mark Pocan is, for the last couple of years, our representative from the 2nd District, has wanted to amend the Constitution to change this, to actually make an affirmative right to vote in the Constitution. And I think that would be a good change. Now, there are laws that have been passed, especially and most significantly the 1965 Voting Rights Act, that provided an equal opportunity to vote for racial minorities, banned literacy tests and other restrictions on the right to vote, and for the first time provided for federal marshals to enforce the law, especially in the South where there had been massive disenfranchisement based on race. And so there have been some affirmative steps, taken to try to protect the right to vote, especially based on race. And there have been other laws passed like the Help America Vote Act back after the 2000 election that did give some financial assistance to states to modernize their voting practices and machinery, but we're still woefully underfunded in terms of that kind of assistance to states in helping modernize our election administration. And also, this is another thing that has made voting so much more difficult in recent years, is what Rick Hazen, probably one of the top election experts in the country on election administration, has written. He had a book a couple of years ago called The Voting Wars, where he points out that over the last decade or so, and especially the last couple of election cycles, it's become a partisan battle. And it didn't used to be this way, that it used to be that both parties worked equally hard to make it easier for people to vote. But in recent years, we've had it polarized on partisan lines, where in states that are dominated by Republican state legislatures and governors, we've seen more things like voter ID laws and making early voting more difficult. And I'll give a more comprehensive list in a minute. But that's the kind of thing that Hazen is talking about with the voting wars. And according to the Brennan Center for Justice, there have been almost 100 bills designed to diminish voter access in the last year in 31 state legislatures. Now, many of those haven't gone through, but some of them have, especially in the wake of the Shelby County versus Holder decision several years ago that weakened part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 4, that had been in place for many years that allowed for the preclearance of discriminatory laws before they went into effect. And that was struck down by the Supreme Court. And so it's made it easier to do things like voter ID laws and other restrictions on voting. So what are some other examples of those tools of voter suppression and what has made it more difficult to vote in some states in recent years? Well, the voter ID laws are a big one. And here in Wisconsin, we have one of the strictest voter ID laws in the country. Limits on early voting. We'd seen a big increase over the previous couple election cycles on more early voting. So some states are cutting that back. Purges of voter registration lists where they and this is something that all states do this on a regular basis, because when people move, people die, you have to clean up your voter rolls. And so sometimes the reporting on a voter purge is forgets that fundamental point. But this is something that should not be done close to an election time, because it causes voter confusion, because there are often people removed from the rolls who were removed accidentally and actually were legitimate registered voters still at the same address. And the problem is that some states, Texas, Georgia, are some of the biggest offenders here, use a process of exact matching, where if the record that is on the voter registration files doesn't exactly match the new information on the voter, they'll be struck from the voter rolls. And then there's this process of voter caging, where they'll send a postcard out to the registered voter. If they don't mail it back, they'll remove you from the rolls. And that, again, has been something that some states have used. And then partisan redistricting, which we saw here in Wisconsin in the last redistricting cycle, that it's really not quite the same in terms of like preventing someone from voting, because it obviously, whatever district you live in doesn't affect your ability to vote, but it could reduce the motivation to vote if you've been moved to a district that has been, you know, packed with so many Democrats, for example. You know that all your local politicians often are running unopposed. And again, there's good research showing that in competitive races, voters are more likely to turn out than in elections in which there's no opposition from the other party. And so partisan redistricting can limit voter turnout in that way. Felon disenfranchisement has been one that's getting a lot of attention in Florida. In 2018, they passed a constitutional amendment in Florida to allow felons who had served their time to be able to vote. But then there was a new law passed by the state legislature that said if they didn't pay their court costs and other fines, then they still couldn't vote. And the problem is that record keeping is so bad that often the felons don't know whether or not they owe money. And there's no like central database that even indicates that. So up to about 900,000 people still probably won't be able to register to vote. They should have been able to after that constitutional amendment was passed. Closing of polling places in urban areas, which leads to longer wait times in voting. We've seen in recent elections, you know, wait times up to 4 or 5 hours long in order to be able to vote. And those, you know, tend to be more concentrated in urban areas rather than rural areas. And then overly broad purges of non-citizens from voter rolls. So citizens obviously are not, non-citizens are not allowed to vote in federal elections. And so some states have made a real effort to purge the non-citizens, but often, again, this leads to actual, you know, legitimate voters being removed from the rolls and can lead to disenfranchisement in that way. And then unequal scrutiny given to mail ballots. Before 10 o'clock, I was on a little early and some of us were talking about how this works in different states. And I gave the example of like in Georgia, clerks will, if you don't include your middle initial, so if I would sign my name on my absentee ballot, David Cannon, instead of David T. Cannon, and my official record said David T. Cannon, there's some clerks who would throw that out. One of my colleagues, Ken Mayer, does a lot of expert witness work in these election cases, and he mentioned a case that he came across, again in Georgia, where you were on the absentee ballot, you're supposed to give the date of your birth. And they meant it to just be the month and day and not the year. And someone put the year down as well and they threw it out. It was just completely ridiculous. And so that kind of disenfranchisement is, you know, really doesn't make sense, but it happens. And then most recently, the post office, you know, all of the changes being made to the post office in terms of like removing sorting machines, actually taking post boxes away, has slowed down the mail precisely at the time when millions of ballots will be coming in for early voting. And so that's another potential problem that could make it harder to vote by mail in this election. And this shows a long-term trend from since 1992. The purple line shows the decline in the percentage of people voting on election day. You can see it's gone, it was, you know, 90% range all the way through 1998. And it's just been on a steady decline down to about 60% in the last two elections, with an increase then in both mail-in ballots, which have gone from about 8 or 9% up to about 22% in the last election. And then early in-person voting has gone from pretty much non-existent to 15% of the electorate voting in person before election day. Probably saw those pictures from Virginia on Friday. They started their in-person early voting, and they had lines up to 4 hours long in many places in Virginia to vote early. So the thing that's been getting a lot of attention over the last couple of months, really since the spring when the first elections are being held during the pandemic, was the huge increase in mail ballots in 2020. And President Trump has politicized this by calling into question the validity of mailed-in ballots, even if he himself has voted by mail recently. So what's the concern here? What actually is going on with this? Well, first of all, I think it's important to recognize the differences in the kinds of absentee voting that we have. First, there are 8 states that have limited absentee voting. So you actually have to have some reason. They have to show that you are actually going to be out of the state on that date, or you have to show that you are, you know, unable physically to be able to go to the polls. And so there has to be some actual reason for voting absentee. Only 8 states have that. 34 states have the no excuse absentee voting, like Wisconsin, where you can just request a ballot, you get it, you can vote absentee. And then there are 5 states that have universal mail for all elections and have had for quite some time, like Oregon. And then there are 3 more states plus DC that are doing universal mail just for 2020 because of the COVID pandemic. Now, President Trump has generally focused his concern on the universal voting by mail, but he also has been critical of efforts to mail ballot request forms to all voters, saying that this could lead to voter fraud. But there's really no evidence for fraud by mail-in voting compared to other methods of voting, or indeed in general. There's very limited evidence for any voter fraud. There was an analysis done by MIT of a database that the Conservative Heritage Foundation has had on election fraud. And they found out for a 20-year period, there were only 143 cases of mail ballot fraud. This is out of, you know, over 250 million votes that they examined. And so this is just a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the overall votes. There was a study done here by our Wisconsin Election Commission of the 2018 election, and they found only 4 cases of fraud out of the 2.7 million votes counted in Wisconsin. And so in Oregon, again, they've been doing the mail-in only voting since 2000, has confirmed only 2 cases of fraud out of 50 million mailed-in votes over that 20-year period. And so it really is just a non-issue to think of fraud as being a problem not to use a mail-in vote. It just doesn't exist. Now, there have been a few examples of what's called ballot harvesting. There was a North Carolina Republican candidate who they actually voided an election because it was a very close race. And there was evidence that they did this ballot harvesting where they would go around getting absentee ballots from people and fraudulently fill them out. There's another case in New Jersey recently where that happened on the Democratic side. But the thing is, with that type of larger scale effort at fraud, is pretty easy to detect. And so the individual, you know, voter who engages in mail fraud is just, you know, again, a minuscule proportion of all votes. And the relatively few cases of bigger examples of, say, ballot harvesting are also both pretty rare, but also are easier to detect and then stop. Now, having said that, while fraud is really not a concern, that there is a bigger concern about the challenge of voting by mail. Nationally, over 20% of ballots aren't returned. Now, we don't know, like many of those people probably change their mind and end up go vote in person, and we don't have the exact breakdown on that. But the mail ballots are rejected at a higher rate than in person. And this is likely to be even more true in 2020 because a lot of the people are voting by mail for the first time. Like here in Wisconsin, we know from the April election and the August primary, we had a huge increase in mail-in voting, and missing addresses of the witnesses was the biggest reason that the ballots were excluded in Wisconsin. Signature match isn't as much of a concern here in terms of voters having their ballots excluded. But in some states, that ends up being pretty significant. And then in the earlier primaries, in the August primary and the April election, one of the big problems was the clerk's offices were just overwhelmed with the demand and they couldn't get the ballots out in time. So a lot of people were not able to vote because they requested their ballot, say, 3 weeks before the election, and it didn't show up in time for them to vote. And so that was compounded, you know, in the August primary by the undermining of the post office. But I think we've turned the corner, at least on the clerks being able to keep up with the demand, that the word has gotten out to people about making sure you request your ballot early. Don't wait until the week before the election, because that's not going to work. And so if you are going to vote by mail, make sure you get that request in now. And it looks like the clerk's offices are being able to keep up a little better than they had been before. And here's just the data from the Wisconsin Election Commission on the April election showing the percent of ballots that were returned and not returned. So of the 1.3 million absentee ballots that were mailed out, a little over 1.1 were actually returned, so about 89%. There were 0.2% that were late, and so they weren't counted because they came in late, again, because of the demand. But another about 20,000 ballots were rejected, so about almost 1.6% of the ballots were rejected. Again, most of those for the missing signature of the witness was, or the missing address of the witness was the most common error. So if you are voting by mail, make sure you do it properly because you want to make sure your vote is counted. Okay, so the other thing that's on everyone's mind right now, and just I'll conclude now with just a few sort of observations about what I think is likely to happen, especially in the wake of the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Which now is putting the Supreme Court at the center of the presidential race again, as it was a pretty prominent role in 2016 as well. So my thought is if Republicans do try to push through a nomination with a vacancy coming just 46 days before the election, you know, after they had denied Obama a nomination when Scalia died, which was 269 days before the election, I think this would galvanize Democratic voters in a way that would make it even more likely that Trump loses and the Democrats win the Senate. And now, on the other hand, if they leave the seat open until after the election, then both sides will be galvanized. You know, Republicans want to make sure they have the shot of another Supreme Court nominee, so that'll help turn out Trump's base. And Democrats will want to, you know, try to replace Ginsburg with a Biden appointee. So I think, given that Mitch McConnell is a pretty savvy politician, my sense is what they're probably going to do, especially given that Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski have already come out saying they think the next president should make this pick, not the current president, two Republican senators that, you know, are a little bit more moderate than many made that statement already. So what I think probably is going to happen is they'll have the pick made and the confirmation hearings, but then not have a vote until after the election. And then it'll be interesting to see, you know, how that plays out. But here's the data. Actually, this is from 538, had a story on this yesterday, showing all of the different nominees, the different Supreme Court justices who died in a presidential election year. And there has never been a nominee in the history of our country who has been confirmed in less than 144 days. So Justice Hughes in 1916 was nominated and confirmed 144 days before the election, that vacancy came. You can see the other five cases that were in that category, none of them had a confirmed justice before that time. And even in three of the four other cases, there was no nominee even. They waited until after the election to even nominate someone. And so this would be truly unprecedented in our history if they were to push ahead, even with the nomination. We've never had a nomination, again, that's been less than 106 days before an election. And so that would be breaking with precedent in terms of having a decision made on a justice so close to the election. So I'll conclude with something that I don't want to make people stay up at night and worry about these things any more than you already are, but this is one that keeps me up at night. So I thought I actually would share this because it is a little scary. So this shows the Electoral College map of kind of where things stand today with polls. I mean, if I had to pick exactly what's going to happen, you know, like in based on the polling, I think I would also put Wisconsin and Michigan for Biden. And so I think Biden would win if the election were held today. But those are definitely states that are still in play and up for grabs. Then you have Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, and the Maine, one congressional district in Maine, because Maine and Nebraska are the two states that actually split their congressional districts rather than winner take all. So the problem with this map, if you look at, and if Trump wins those four toss-ups, if he wins Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, and that one electoral vote in Maine, look what happens. You get a 269 to 269 tie. You would have a tied electoral college. And this has never happened to have an exact tie. But you, if that happens, this gets thrown into the House of Representatives and each state gets one vote. And this is one of the craziest things about the electoral college that a lot of people don't realize because we haven't had it happen since 1800. And that is to, or 1824, I guess, is the last time it happened. And so each state gets one vote, meaning like North and South Dakota, little old North and South Dakota, Wyoming, states with like, you know, 600,000 people will get the same say in electing our president as California and Florida and Texas and New York, the big states. So, and it would come down to likely a razor thin margin, but it looks like Trump would probably win with 26 of the 50 states if that were to happen. It would be like really, really close. So anyway, again, that's pretty unlikely you get to that tie, but it's not that unlikely an electoral college map. I mean, it's, that's pretty much how things stand today with, again, I would say Michigan and Wisconsin Pennsylvania Pennsylvania is the one I think I'd also put in the Biden camp, because Wisconsin and Michigan already are in Biden camp. I misspoke before. So this outcome, they already are leaning in that direction. So this is not that far from what could be actually likely to happen. So I'll stop sharing the slides and we can take your questions and open things up for discussion.
So thank you so very much. I appreciated your broad perspective and your focus on Wisconsin. It's very helpful.
That our turnout, even in high turnout years, tends to be lower than most other parliamentary Western democracies. Like they just, we are about 10 to 15 points below, at least 10 usually, 10 to 15 points below turnout in most other Western democracies. And so I think there are probably two main reasons for this. One is our two-party system compared to the multi-party systems you see in most other Western democracies. That when you have a proportional representation with multi-party system, you allow for a much broader diversity of partisan perspectives to be on the ballot. And so, if you're a Green Party, supporter in this country, you really have no chance in having your candidate win ever. If you're a Libertarian Party, supporter in this country, you have no chance of having your candidate win ever. And so you're basically in the position then, if you're on, the more ideological extremes, of having to either throw your vote away by voting for a third party candidate, which in an election like this, the stakes are really high to do that, or to vote for one of the two major party candidates you really probably don't care for that much. In a multi-party system, you can have representation in the national legislature if you get as few as 5% of the votes. And so in most countries, that gives you a very low threshold then to be able to participate in national politics, basically. Mm-hmm. And so there's more of an incentive to vote for that reason. So that's one reason. The other is we have a lot of elections in this country, way more than most other countries. Mm-hmm. Just think about the number of times that, Wisconsin voters have voted in the last, 10 years, we average at least, two elections per year, if not more. And if you go back to like the Walker recalls and, so we have elections, the April, just in general, we have the April elections, April primaries, the fall primaries and fall elections in even numbered years. So four elections, in every even numbered year. And that's way more than other countries have. So I think there's something of like voter fatigue that sets in as well. And we do see higher turnout in presidential elections, of course, than in the midterm elections. But I think that would be the second explanation for why turnout is lower. And then, the institutional reasons, like you mentioned, in Australia, the having mandatory voting. And there are, you know, other things in our country, like the voter ID laws that make it harder to vote as well, that factor into this. It's a personal contact is definitely been shown to have, you know, more of an impact than anything else. And so, like, the knock on the door, the sharing on Facebook, getting your friends to vote. And so it's personal contact that definitely has the biggest effect. And there also is some work that's been informed by the behavioral economists of the last few years who look at like changing motivations, you know, for different kinds of economic behavior based on what other people are doing. And so there are also some evidence that, you know, showing people your voting record compared to other people's voting records, if you just, you know, point out to someone, you know, you're not voting as much as maybe other people in your community are voting, that also can serve as a motivation to get people to vote more. And in fact, I just received a mailing yesterday that was, I can't remember the organization, but it did exactly that. It showed my voting history, you know, for the last like 5 election cycles, and it gave what the average, you know, voter turnout was in, I think it was in Dane County. Now, I haven't missed an election in, you know, 20 years, so mine was okay. But if yours came out, like, you only vote a third of the time, and everyone else in your community is voting like 80% of the time, it could maybe shame you into voting. So that's another thing that actually has been shown to be somewhat effective, but it's the personal contact is the most effective. Yeah, it's a hard one to be able to pin down, because the only way you can do that, you know, you can't actually do that for our country, because you'd have to like run an experiment where you'd have a, you know, one election with a holiday and the next election you wouldn't. And clearly they're not going to be willing to experiment that way. So the only way you can try to suss it out is by comparative analysis, but comparing our country to other countries that do have election holidays. But the problem is then there's so many other variables too, of different election laws, a multi-party system versus two-party system. So it really is a tough one to sort out. And so there's no clear answer to that specific question of like, would a voter holiday help? Because you're absolutely right, it could cut both ways. I mean, you know, it could help like some people maybe, but not enough people. And so I think other things, like, you know, things we know that work are things like election day registration. That is a huge one. We have that here in Wisconsin. There are about 10 states now that do. That's one of the biggest things that really helps, is to be able to register to vote on election day at the polls. Because one thing we do know about people is that they are procrastinators and they forget stuff. And so, like, if you live in a state that has a 30-day window to register 30 days before election, before a lot of states do, you're just simply out of luck. If, like, October 10th rolls around and you're like, oh, shoot, we have an election coming up, I'm not registered to vote. Too bad, you can't register at that point. And there are a lot of states that have really restrictive laws like that. So having election day registration, that alone boosts turnout by like 8 to 10%. It's a huge, huge thing, like much bigger than a national holiday. So one thing I would advocate, you know, for any state that, you know, wants to boost voter turnout, that's the single best thing that could be done is having election day registration. And that's one reason Wisconsin is always in the top 2 or 3 in the country in turnout. It's always Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Maine are like 1, 2, and 3 in turnout. We're always right up there towards the top. And election day registration is one reason that's the case, I think.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much, David Cannon.
Yeah,
appreciate your sharing your insights and your research in terms of specifically this election, with the very latest update in terms of the questions on the Supreme Court, which all of a sudden have made things very interesting. I mean, on a whole, as if they weren't interesting already.
Yeah, for sure.
So thank you so very much.
All right. Well, it's good to be with you.